guide wherever you may be. We ain't met yet, but I'm willing to bet you're the gal for me. Bless your beautiful hide, you're just as good as lost. I don't know your name, but I'm mistaken my claim, lest your eyes is crossed. Oh, I'd swap my gun and I'd swap my mule, though whoever took it would be one big fool. Or pay your way through cooking school, if in you would say I do.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. I'm your host, Kirk Greenfield, and I'm joined by three other hosts for a team of four for a very special episode. Yes, this is one of those special episodes like the ABC After School specials that you all saw as kids, where we cover a special, unique topic that is almost outside of our usual haunts, but it's going to be tied in beautifully. So part of our panel here, I'm Kirk Greenfield, as I already mentioned, and we also have Tim Elliott.
Hello.
And Brian Hughes.
Hi-de-ho.
And Nigel Spink from Japan.
Hello there.
So we've gathered together tonight to discuss one of a series of books. I don't know how to put this in context really well. This is going to be Avengers West Coast Annual Number 4, which falls in the continuity of the John Byrne stories that we've been covering, but in fact, it's part of a summertime annual sweep, a massive storyline, but we're only going to focus on this annual because it's the only one that John Byrne wrote, drew, penciled. Correct me, guys, how much of an involvement did he have in this?
He did the pencils and the story, but Terry Austin did the inks.
So this is a special presentation, and it ties into some of the ongoing storyline. However, it's not essential to be read, so we're going to cover it tonight. Who has the first information that wants to present? Brian, are you up first?
That'd be Tim.
That's me. I did the synopsis.
Okay,
Kirk, thanks for that lovely introduction. So, as Kirk says, this is part of the Atlantis Attacks summer annual crossovers. And this is something that Marvel did for several years. They did a big crossover of all their annuals in the summer. This is the Atlantis Attacks storyline. And the Avengers, because we were covering Avengers West Coast, we decided to go ahead and cover this because you can really separate this from the storyline from the main books, but they do reference it in the books you've already covered. So we thought we'll cover it as being completionists. So this really slots in between, let me get my notes here. This slots in between Avengers West Coast 52 and 53. So if you're reading those, then you finish 52, you could read this, come back to 53. Okay. And I've got a brief, just a brief plot outline for the Atlantis Attacks overarching story. And I grabbed this right off Wikipedia. So if there's any mistakes, I'm not taking responsibility for them. Atlantis Attacks. The disembodied Gower, who is a deviant, baits the Silver Surfer into restoring his physical form by hijacking the Silver Surfer's surfboard. After a brief battle, Gower escapes and flees to Earth, where he convinces Lemuria's ruler, Lyra, to form an alliance to summon Set back to Earth. This is his plan. Fivefold plot here. Number one, build a brand new giant-sized serpent crown via gathering a large amount of mystic artifacts and melting them down into building material for the new serpent crown. Forging an alliance with Atuma, ruler of Atlantis.
It's not Atuma.
And convince him. And convince him to declare war on the surface world as a means to render Atlantis defenseless due to Atuma devoting all of the city's military resources towards a surface world invasion.
It's not Atuma!
So that Gower and Lyra's forces could launch a massive military assault on Atlantis, slaughtering thousands of innocent civilians as a sacrificial offering to Set. Number three, transform the human population into mute serpent men using a serpent formula conceived by the terrorist known as the Viper, with a deposed underground tyrant, Tyrannus, injecting recovering drug addicts with the chemical. Number four, kidnap 7 superpowered heroines for the purposes of becoming brides for Set, ultimately for the purpose of becoming pregnant with the 7-headed serpent's god's children. Number 5. Use the superheroine Dagger, one of the women selected as a bride for Set, and a special magical magnifying glass to magnify the potency of a portion of Set's life force into a viable amount of life energy to give life to the giant serpent crown, allowing Set's exiled essence to possess the now mindless 7-headed serpent body and return to Earth. Everybody got that? However, as their plans are countered at just about every turn by Earth's heroes, culminating with the Avengers, the FF, Namor the Submariner, who was believed dead for the bulk of the storyline during a skirmish with Iron Man, and Atuma's military forces.
It's not Atuma!
Defeating Gower and Lyra and stopping them from bringing Set to Earth. So that is the overall story. And what we're going to be covering is part 12 of that. I think it's a 14-part story. So we're towards the end of the story.
So this ready. Is basically, Gower is David Lopan by a proxy.
Exactly. It's exactly. Yeah.
Look, we came here to see David Lopan, all right?
You have succeeded, Mr. Burton.
What, you? I don't get this at all. I thought Lopan...
Shut up, Mr. Burton. You are not brought upon this world to get it.
Come on, Lopan is like...
Nothing you can understand.
And we all know Gower's a bad guy because he slapped Jimmy Stewart in the ear and made him bleed. Okay, are we ready? This is West Coast Avengers Annual number 4. They cover price of...
Do we want to cover the... Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, I'll shut up.
No, okay, that's all right. Cover price $2. Our writer-artist is John Byrne, and he is teamed with Terry Austin. Colorist is Bob Sheeran. Letter is Jack Morelli. Our cover art's John Byrne. Our editor is still Howard Mackey, and our editor-in-chief is still Tom DeFalco. It's had a release date of July 4th, 1989, and a cover date of November 1989. There are 64 pages, but we're only covering the first story, which is what Byrne worked on, not the backup stories. And this is reprinted in several... The Atlantis Attacks Omnibus, The Avengers by John Byrne Omnibus, The Avengers West Coast Epic Collection Vision Quest, I don't know why that's in that one, and The Atlantis Attacks, the original Epic trade paperback. Brian, you're going to tell us what other books, you've got a more complete list. What are the other books that Byrne worked on at this time?
Okay, well, the list that we had was kind of, let me get that pulled up correctly here. It was a little... kind of odd in the way it was done because it showed us the annuals as well as this. Let me see here. I had the page up and all of a sudden it went out of my... Yeah, here we are. Okay, so we got Avengers West Coast 50 and 51 since it was, we're getting 2 books a month. Classic X-Men is a reprint of X-Men 132 Wolverine Alone and Classic X-Men 40 Too Late the Heroes. Then there was Marvel Age 81, and that was the reason why he's focused there was because it was the promo for X of Vengeance. And so you had the cover that had all the Marvel villains on it in purple. And then there was a lot of promo material inside for it as well. Then we've got Avengers Proper 309 and 310 and Ohatmu's 5 and 6. That's the deluxe edition, I believe. Oh, the update 89. Sensational She-Hulk number 7 and 8. And then Wolverine 17. Yeah. And then on the list of annuals, because... these came out during the summer, but Byrne had a hand in several of the annuals that were part of the Atlantis Attack story. So if you want to kind of follow along, if you're going to go through the whole thing just to read it all, these are ones where he's involved. Iron Man Annual 10, there was the second story in it called Can You Top This? Takes place in a bar with a bunch of supervillains talking about how they almost beat Iron Man. And John Byrne did one splash page where the Space Phantom was telling them about how he almost beat the Avengers by getting into Iron Man's golden armor. Then Amazing Spider-Man Annual 23, he did the front cover, which was the Abomination holding the car above his head and over Spider-Man. Avengers Annual 18, part of the Atlantis Attacks, that one he did the front cover on, and I got to say that's probably the ugliest cover Burns ever done, and that's just my opinion. Then there is, of course, we were talking about West Coast Avengers Annual 4, and finally X Factor Annual 4, where he does the art and Walt Simonson does the inks in the Atlantis Attack storyline. I think that's got everything. Did I miss something?
Nope, that's it. Okay, thank you for that, Brian. Let's get into the meat of this issue. As we said, this is Avengers West Coast Annual number 4, titled Gather Ye Now, Seven Brides. This is chapter 12 of the Atlantis Attacks. And as I said, this slots in between Avengers West Coast 52 and 53. Location, the Pacific Ocean. Seven women stand motionless before Gower, the priest king of the Deviants, each chosen to be the bride of the elder god Set. Storm, chosen in X-Men Annual number 9. She-Hulk, chosen in Amazing Spider-Man Annual 23. Dagger, chosen in Spectacular Spider-Man Annual number 9. Scarlet Witch, chosen in Avengers Annual number 18. Jean Grey, chosen in X-Factor Annual number 4. Andromeda, daughter of Atlantean warlord Atuma, chosen in X-Factor Annual number 4. And finally, the Invisible Woman, chosen in Web of Spider-Man Annual number 4. The women start to march in line towards the bonding chamber when Dagger stumbles and a guard threatens her for being clumsy. Gower steps in and realizes the young woman is blind. One of the Deviants remarks it makes no difference since the humans did not slaughter the Atlanteans and Set cannot be resurrected. Gower says the blood sacrifice was necessary, but there is still hope and the Seven Brides will be the new sacrifice. Cut to the Eastern Seaboard. The Human Torch flies towards Avengers' compound, reminiscing about his recent resurrection. Inside the HQ, it's been 8 hours since the Scarlet Witch was abducted. The Vision, Captain America, Beast, Iron Man, Wonder Man, Quasar, and the Eternal Circe are gathered around a table. The Beast tells the group Marvel Girl was abducted while Wonder Man feels the Vision is being too cold and emotionless, considering his wife is taken. Cap asks Circe to join them because the Eternals have been at war with the Deviants for a millennia. The remaining Avengers are offside helping clean up the Serpent Cult and dealing with the remains of the Atlantean Attack Force. See previous summer annuals. Cap wants to focus on rescuing the seven women when Ben Grimm enters. He tells them Susan Storm was taken and rediscovered the attack by the Atlanteans with subterfuge. They were meant to be killed fighting the heroes, therefore fulfilling the blood sacrifice to bring forth Set. Thor tells the group a little about Set's history and the importance of vanquishing him back to the Nether Realms. 400 miles off New England and deep below the surface, She-Hulk and Andromeda swim towards the altar of Neptune's wrath. She-Hulk thinks to herself how it's strange that she has complete control over her body unless she tries to resist Gower's orders, but then she is compelled to complete her mission. Atlanteans once worshipped Neptune at the altar until they turned to Set. Neptune's anger was vast, and he smote the ancient place. Neptune shattered Set's soul, and the fragment was trapped within the altar. She-Hulk dives deep into the altar, followed by Andromeda, who warns the green-skinned hero to beware of a giant sea beast that guards the remains of Set. Wondering what a piece of an elder god looks like, She-Hulk spots a glowing object wedged on a stone platform. She tries to free it when suddenly the two are surrounded by several giant tentacles. Cut to the Museum of Cultural Antiquities in Chicago. Jean Grey is sitting in the curator's office. He thanks her for presenting the museum with an ancient Lemurian crown. One condition is that she must be allowed to inspect the building's security. Curator leads her down a flight of steps to the display vault, explaining the security measures they have put in place. He shows how all the artifacts are on lifts and can be lowered from the floor above. He demonstrates by lowering one when an invisible ball knocks him out. Susan Storm becomes visible, and Jean Grey lowers the lens of power. The two women walk past the guards unseen thanks to the Invisible Woman. Meanwhile, a fishing trawler brings the guardian of the Altar of Neptune's Wrath to the surface with She-Hulk in its grasp. A Quinjet has traced an SOS to the scene of the Leviathan. Iron Man flies out to confront the monster as he ponders his decision to keep his real identity a secret from the world and the Avengers. His repulsor blasts have no effect, so he tries an electrical charge. He then spots She-Hulk as a creature drags her beneath the surface. The Golden Avenger dives in to rescue her, but gets a right across the helmet for his trouble. On the surface, Wonder Man tries his fists against the Beast. Circe would use her powers of transmutation, but she said the strain would probably kill her. Well, the Vision steps forward and phases deep within the Guardian. He reaches its heart and, shifting his density slightly, causes the creature to pass out. Iron Man emerges with a stunned She-Hulk. Andromeda escaped with the fragment of Seth's life force and delivers it to Gower. The Deviant regrets the loss of She-Hulk, but Seth will have to settle for only 6 brides. Aboard the fishing boat, Wonder Man and the Beast try to subdue a struggling She-Hulk. Cersei suggests they let the She-Hulk go and that she can trace her telepathically back to Gower. The Hulk's cousin dives overboard and the Avengers follow in their Quinjet. Back in Lemuria, Gower slaps Dagger for failing to use her power correctly. She must focus her light daggers into a slender beam. Then Susan and Jean return with the lens. Susan sets it on a pedestal as Gower announces Set will rise within the hour. Less than a mile away, the Avengers swim towards Lemuria thanks to a little ichthyological transmutation from Cersei. The water breathers break in, and Cersei seals the hole and changes our heroes back to air breathers. Iron Man and the Vision wade through the Deviant Warriors, and Cap barks orders. Dagger, focusing her life energy through the lens and into the fragment of Set, Gower is informed of the Avengers' attack and orders Storm to repel them. She calls up thunder and lightning against Captain America. He manages to counter each of her attacks, and also manages to distract her long enough for the Wasp to sneak up behind her and stun her. The Beast and Wonder Man subdue a guard, and Simon smashes the lens before the fragment of Set could be infused with enough life force. Gower improvises. Grabbing the Scarlet Witch, he orders the other brides to stop Wonder Man. He rushes Wanda to the glowing fragment. The Mutant Witch uses her reality-warping powers to complete the infusion. The fragment begins to glow. Beast runs in and thrusts an iron gauntlet he took from one of the guards into the glowing mass. Iron and mystic powers do not mix. He is thrown back with a mighty boom. Cap orders the Avengers to assemble as a 7-headed serpent slowly rises from the floor. Be continued in Thor Annual number 14 next week.
It says it's a 36-page story, but it's what is it, 22?
Yeah, it's not that long a story.
It goes by so quickly. I was really, really surprised. I want to take a look at this real quick.
I think they've numbered the ad pages as well.
Yeah, it's, let's see. Oh, you got to go into the story itself. 30 pages. So, yeah, 30 pages of story, I guess. But, man, I mean, it just reads really, really quick. And I have some comments in regards to the art. Before we get to that, I just want to point out a couple things that I don't know the readers would be cognizant of. Number one is that the time in which this was printed, 89, from 80, about 86 to 89, is when they were really making use of the flexographic printing. And as a result, a lot of the books had a very muddy look to it. I found that in the case with this particular issue. So even though you had the fine penciling of Byrne and the inks of Terry Austin there, the printing just made it look thick and muddy. Now, I'm looking at a copy in the Avengers Omnibus, Avengers Annual, Avengers Omnibus that is mostly Byrne work. And it is so crisp and so clean and so beautiful that it makes the printed issue look like crap. Like somebody, tore it up, mashed it back together, and then took a pee on it, you know? that's all I'll say on that subject. But I thought that bear mentioning. The other thing was in the omnibus, they had to actually add a separator page in there. You had the double page where it showed each of the brides of Set and Gower in those white awful outfits, and then the next page is when she's sending them and Dagger trips. And there's a red page with the Axe of Vengeance surprint in there that's in between that. So they can keep the pages spaced right. So when you got to the last page or the last two pages, which is all one image, they would be on the same page. So if anybody's wondering why is there, that's why that is.
Interesting.
But yeah, guys, what did you all think? The thing was, I didn't read the other issues leading up to this, and yet I was engrossed in this while reading. I had never read it until just the other day because I didn't have any interest in the whole Atlantis attacks. I looked at the art, but I never really had read the story itself. So it kept me engrossed, and the storyline with the dialogue and everything was just enough to tell you what you needed to know.
Yeah, it was a little heavy on exposition, but that's what you get when you've got part, you know, one part out of 14, you're going to have to space out what's going on. So there's a lot of tying up what had happened and setting up what's going to happen. But I know I bought these when they came in 89, when they were on the shelf, but, and I read them, but I flushed it right out of my mind. I don't remember. I barely remember any of this when I reread this before we did this show. But I don't feel that it was muddy. I didn't, you know, I'm the first one that'll say that when Burns sometimes inking himself, it looks a little muddy. I didn't get that impression from this. I thought
That's not what I was saying. What I'm saying is that the printing came out muddy.
Yeah, the printing is. Yeah, it's a little lackluster. Yeah, it's not. I'm sure it looks nicer in the omnibuses where they cleaned it up. But yeah, yes. you can. You know, it's a little. The colors aren't washed out, but it's got that kind of flat look where some of them you can almost see through the pages and see what's the artwork on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nigel, did you read this in its first run?
Yes, I. This was one of the only parts of Atlantis Attacks that I bought, simply because it was Byrne artwork. I always thought that I got the Avengers annual as well, Avengers 18, but I've recently been looking through these others and I'm not so sure I did anymore. But I know I had more than just this one. I think I might have had the final two parts of the story as a result of reading this one.
Yeah.
I probably picked up the Thor and the Fantastic Four annuals, which finished off the story. But I don't have any of them anymore, I'm going to say. With us covering this, and I've been looking at this again, I really regret that I got rid of this annual. Yeah, I wish I'd have kept it. But at the time I thought, well, although it's Byrne art, what's the point in keeping one part of a 14-part story?
Yeah.
And so when I was trimming down my, my collection, I let it go. But I've been looking at the other stuff in the other annuals because I never read them originally. And like this one is head and shoulders, if not more, above just about everything else in this Atlantis Attacks. For art, you know, in regard to the artwork.
You know, this cover price at $2 a piece, you're talking about a 14-part story. At the time, if you wanted to be there for the entire story arc, you're talking about a fan who's used to shelling out $1 a book, shelling out $28 to cover this huge arc.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm with you, Nigel. I pick and chose, and I think I took only the Bernard, and that's why it doesn't stand in my memory either.
Yeah, and a lot of the others, as I say, I've been looking through now that I found these digital copies, and some of the artwork is awful. So I can understand why I didn't buy them at the time. Maybe I picked one or two of the others up off the shelf thinking, ooh, what's this Atlantis Attacks thing? And then I'd just look at the art and think, oh my God, it's awful. So it wasn't till this one came out and I thought, oh, Byrne art, yay, I'll buy that one. There's only really four of these annuals that have got decent artwork. That's this one. X-Factor 4, of course, where Byrne did pencils and it was inked by Walt Simonson or Simonson. The Silver Surfer one, I quite like that. I like Ron Lim's artwork. And maybe the Web of Spider-Man one, which came just before the Avengers West Coast one. That's not bad artwork. But some of the others are shocking.
Well, sometimes they would, before they kind of start doing these big company-wide crossovers they did for a couple of years, a lot of times my feeling was the annuals were, a lot of times they were not by the main artist on the book, and it was almost like they were giving someone a tryout. Oh, here's someone, maybe you're up and coming, we're going to give it to this artist and let them take a shot at it. So a lot of times the artwork was not as nearly as good as the main books.
And that's fine.
If you look in this one, the last story, the artwork was done by Mark Bagley. And Mark Bagley, of course, became very popular with his Ultimate Spider-Man work. Of course, what made him most famous was that he was the first guy to win a job at Marvel through the Marvel tryout book. But yeah, his artwork, I like it a lot.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Bagley.
Yeah, yep.
He's not bad. No, what I was going to say...
His later stuff gets much better. What
I was going to say, Tim, going back to what you just mentioned about, they use the annuals for, like, new artists to try out. That's okay when you're doing individual annuals, which don't sort of connect with anything else. But when you're doing a complete story like Atlantis Attacks was supposed to be, all connected to one another.
Crossover event, yeah.
Yeah, you need something where the art's going to be more consistent. Yeah, that's the word. And this is not. No. But a lot of them were like that, yeah. The artwork was a bit of a letdown in that other one. Oh, I always forget their name. What's the big robot things that they're not robots. Terminus. The Terminus Factor, is it?
Oh, yes, I forgot.
The artwork in that was awful, too.
I think I was surprised that didn't realize we were covering West Coast that Byrne did this annual, because I know a lot of times he wouldn't want to do, if he's doing his storyline and then editorial says, hey, you got to come in, we're doing this crossover, you've got to do this, which is really nothing that he wants to work with. He would not want to do it, but I guess he'd rather have him do it than somebody else.
Yeah, this was kind of part of the problem though in the end, wasn't it, with Avengers West Coast?
Yeah,
I mean, like you say, he did take part in this one, but he, I think you said that he originally proposed his Immortus story for the annual stories, and they rejected that. But yeah, they didn't expect him to carry on doing his own story, I guess, in the Avengers West Coast.
And that's got to be frustrating if you've got your stories plotted out and you're cooking along and doing your stuff. They tell you, oh, you've got to slot. I know we talked about that on his, Brian, help me out. Was it the Alpha Flight where they forced him to put the, or is FF, they forced him to put the Beyonder in his issue and he was resistant to that?
It's definitely, it was both Fantastic Four and Alpha Flight that he had a Beyonder appearance, Beyonders. I believe.
Yeah, well, because the Alpha Flight's one where he switched with Bill Mantlow to they switched books.
Yeah, but
he took the Hulk.
Yeah,
he took on the Hulk, and Mantlow took over Alpha Flight.
Yeah.
I did think it's interesting this first splash page where you see all the brides. We get a size kind of comparison, and if this is true to life, I don't know if it is or not. But Wanda's quite tall, because she is like second highest or tallest compared to. Of course, Dagger is quite short.
Maybe Andromeda's just got the edge on her.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But, and we've never really seen Andromeda before that much. I don't recall from anywhere.
I don't either. I don't know.
I wouldn't have figured that Storm would have been taller than the Scarlet Witch, and it may just be a hair thing that makes her taller.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah, I was going to ask who Andromeda was or what book she came from, because most of these characters I recognize, but Andromeda... I'm a blank.
Well, wasn't she the mother of Cassiopeia? Oh, wait, sorry. We're not talking.
Wrong gun, Roman.
Well, they're probably drawing from that, but does anybody know where she hails from?
I don't. She just says she's Atuma's daughter, and that's all I know.
I'd never seen her before this.
Yeah, me either. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for at least explaining that she's Atuma's daughter.
But on the costume that he's got them wearing, this white robe with the unitard or whatever you call that, the She-Hulk's one, because of the way it looked on her, it looked like her original non-costume from the Savage She-Hulk series. Because she was always wearing a white outfit and then regular slacks. And, of course, the slacks would go away and it'd just be the white outfit that's all torn up.
Well, also I was reading it, but it states in here that Dagger is blind. And I thought, when did she become blind? Well, apparently there was a new cloak. It was called the Mutant Misadventures of Cloak and Dagger. It started a year before, and it was a new series. It ran about 18 issues, and she was blinded in that run. So that's why she's blind here.
Yeah, I thought, I'm sure she wasn't blind when they first brought Cloak and Dagger out.
Yeah. Now, the second actual story page I say it that way because it's got that table of contents. But, you know, the second actual story page, when it shows all the brides, in the second panel with Storm, what is the deal with that one alien there that looks like Elmer Fudd on Sirius?
He looks cross-eyed. Colors? He looks cross-eyed, yeah. Doesn't he?
Yeah. Now, all the aliens here remind me of the aliens that we saw in the Dark Phoenix saga in X-Men 137 when they're brought to the Shi'ar vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And they're teleporting. You got all those aliens and whatnot that are there. That's what they all remind me of.
I was thinking of the trial of Reed Richards.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
So, and again, same group.
I think these are all supposed to be deviants.
Yeah.
I think. I don't know much about the deviants, but that's how it lists them in the Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one grabbing hold of.
Now, the deviants, of course, are the cast-offs from the actual Eternals, right? They're the ones that the Eternals are actually supposed to fight in the movie,
mm-hmm.
where Angelina Jolie played Cersei.
Yes, except they are all, in the movie, they were all just kind of treated as these mindless things, weren't they?
Yeah.
Something like that. Kirk, just for your information, Andromeda first showed up in New Defenders 143 in 85. So at the time of this book, she hadn't been around very long.
Maybe they were trying to sell her, or at least give her more exposure.
Well, they couldn't find another girl, or I guess another female that could be a bride.
I guess it's topical that she fits in with this story. Yeah?
Exactly, because
Sue Richards is already married. I don't understand the criteria for their brides unless just give me a prominent female from each of the Marvel books.
I think that's it. Yeah. I mean, they could have easily picked the Wasp or think of another Avenger. Well, this also slots in with Wanda. Kind of, this is all the turmoil she's going through that kind of leads up to her in issue 56, 57 when she kind of snaps. So it's just all, I mean, this is literally followed. You know, first she lost her husband, and then she lost her kids, and then she gets abducted and, you know, tries to become the Bride of Set. And then she, you know, so she comes back, and that's what kind of leads her to kind of going off the rails. Yeah. A little
now, bit. I can tell you this, you know, I made the comment earlier about David Lopan, but because of the way this story was structured and everything, I heard James Hong every time I was reading Gower's, word balloons. It was very much Big Trouble in Little China for me.
I didn't think about Lopan, but he's exactly right to fit in his place. Yeah.
Okay. Now this is, I don't know if I have to think that Byrne did it on purpose, but on the page where the Human Torch is coming back, and of course this is the Android Human Torch, is coming back at the very bottom of that page, there is every character involved on the Avengers side that's in the story. And it, of course, every one of them is colored except for one.
Quasar,
who's way at the back. I mean, Quasar, I think, is in two panels of the whole story, really. And just otherwise completely ignored. And I have to say that was on purpose by Byrne, because Quasar was pushed on him by Mark Grunewald.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine if, because Byrne says at the beginning, be sure to read West Coast 50 before you read this. Mm-hmm. If you didn't or didn't have it, then you're like, what's the Torch doing in here? Where would he come back?
Yeah. And would they have realized that was an Android Human Torch?
Well,
I mean, it doesn't really even say so here, does it?
If they read what he's thinking in the second panel, because he says, except for that brief encounter a few years ago with my young heir apparent, the present day Human Torch.
Yep.
Well, and they would see the way Byrne distinctly draws. He doesn't do any facial features on when he's doing Jim Hammond as opposed to Johnny Storm.
Yep. And then on the next page, the Vision, his right arm looks a little oversized. it stuck out to me as I was reading it, and I was going, what's going on here?
He made it more dense.
It looks more like the Ace's arm from the Royal Flesh Gang. But, and then his left arm is like, looks like he's getting ready to get put on the rigging so they can pull him up in the air and make him fly like Christopher Reeve did. The way he's got his arms out like that. Yeah. Just weird. Okay, I'm going to address something here that I was thinking about. as I was looking at this over and over. This is basically 10 years later, after Terry Austin and John Byrne pretty much stopped working together. They had one issue of the Fantastic Four that they worked on together, and I'm not sure what else that they, if they did anything else together in that time. But you can definitely see that both of them had a change in styles that kind of pulled them away from each other a little bit. And I think the most apparent change on Byrne's side is that he seems to pull the camera in further in each of the regular panels. All the smaller panels, the camera's in much closer on everybody, the faces and everything. That one panel I pointed out that had Quasar at the back, that was very un-Byrne-like for this era. He doesn't typically do it that small a panel for that many characters. And that was his bread and butter back at, you know, 10 years before. And just in the look of the Byrne and Austin together here is not as organic as it was during the X-Men days. And I think that goes back to Austin using more brushes and definitely a lot less zip tone. Style of inking is a lot different.
It does not look nearly as crisp. If you look at those, they're in the heyday of their X-Men run. And it looks a little like Austin is a little lighter on the inks. He's not, yeah. And it's more in the ink lines. He doesn't have a lot of weight to him. So
it's more to the artist's leanings.
Yeah, you miss a little bit of the weight that you would get with the stuff. And yeah, the Zipitone definitely makes a difference. And it's certainly dense, because when you look at the scenes where when She-Hulk and Andromeda are underwater, those are nicely filled in. And then the creature that comes up is nicely drawn. That's very detailed. This, because it almost looks like it's made out of vines or something.
It's Octogroot.
It's something.
Is what I was thinking, because it looks like wood.
Yeah, it does. It looks like it reminds me a little bit of the plant creatures from the Submariner run. Kirk and I did.
You mean you're talking about the hyacinth?
The hyacinth, yes.
The hyacinth.
And do you think it was another intentional bit when Byrne put that guy at the was at the Museum of Cultural Antiquities, that the guy looks a little bit like Byrne?
It could be a little self-referential. Yeah, I mean, he's got the ponytail.
At this point, he had a full buzz on his head. Kept his hair very, very short.
Except this guy's a ginger.
He's a mixture of somebody else on the staff. I can't identify who it is. I think he uses Marvel staff members frequently as photo references, but, you know,
yeah.
Sprinkle them in to see if fans notice.
Yeah. Yeah, but after all this, it was a pleasure to read. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to mention, and that was Wonder Man being, you know, in his head, incredibly critical of the Vision, when he's the reason why the Vision is that way. I mean, he's the one who could not allow Vision to get his brain in, you know, his brain engrams or whatever you want to call that, so that he would be more like he was before and probably fall in love with Scarlet Witch and all that. Yeah, well, if you've given that to him, then yeah, he would be that concerned.
Well, that slots in with what's going on in the main book that they were trying to get Simon to donate his brain patterns to try to restore. And even, maybe we're jumping the gun here, but even later the Vision says, I think the Vision turns him down. It says, no, I don't want him, because even if I took them, I wouldn't be the same. It still wouldn't make me the same person that Wanda, he wouldn't restore him back to normal. So he wants to kind of be his own guy.
Right. But that being said, what Simon is thinking is perfectly normal for someone that's going through what he's going through.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The emotional havoc, the spurts of jealousy or whatever. Yeah, that is natural and normal. So I give props to the writer on that.
How do you think about... Oh, go ahead, Kirk.
Well, I was just going to say, we were talking about Sue Richards and being in this museum. I wanted to bring something up on the bottom of that page. I'm looking at a scan that says at page 15, when they club the curator or whatever his name is. And then Sue materializes or becomes visible. She and Jean decide to take the lens at the top of page 16, and then the second panel. I have a problem here. Sue Richards can turn invisible. She can make other objects invisible. She can make other people invisible. But she can't do all three at the same time. Unless something specifically has been changed, it was defined that her powers were when she's invisible and she makes somebody else invisible, she trades off. She becomes visible. So it's one or the other. I'm really surprised to see the burn.
Unless but hasn't she made herself and Reed invisible at times?
I assume she must have, but that's not the original power. There were specific limitations introduced when they introduced her force field and her ability to make other people invisible.
Yeah, but the thing is that when Byrne took over the Fantastic Four, if you read even the very first issue that he did when he took over as writer, 232, she talks about how Reed had her doing things to exercise her powers more. Like she's wearing her Fantastic Four outfit underneath her regular clothes, and she's got that outfit invisible. Whereas all you can see is her regular clothes. But when she needs to become the invisible girl at that point in time, she would make her outer clothes invisible, so all you can see was her Fantastic Four outfit. And so she was doing that constantly to the point where it just became second nature. Now, when you do something like that, that's, again, it's like working a muscle. And so she just became stronger and able to do a lot more. The other thing you could use here as an explanation is that Gower's spell probably increased her concentration in those areas because that's where her focus was supposed to be.
Or
just like that.
They could have fixed it as maybe Susan with the lens is invisible. And then Jean, because she walked in, she could easily manipulate the guards into thinking the curator is still with her and they're walking out together, or cloud their minds so they don't see her so that she is in effect invisible.
I'll give you both no prizes on that.
I'll be looking in the mail for it.
What did you guys think of, we'll go back a couple pages. I like the way Byrne has drawn Cersei because he's really channeling Jack Kirby. I thought he did a nice job of drawing her kind of the Kirby style. And that we're in a page, you only get to see her in a couple panels, but that close up next to, it's on page 8. You get to see her on the middle panel on the right. And then later when you see her on the ship, when she says she can't change the this beast into something else because the strain would be too much for her.
You know, it's in that last... Or the, I guess it'll be the next episode. The issue was it, I don't remember which one it was, but I think it was probably the last issue. There was a backup story where Cap and the Human Torch are reunited. And yeah, if you remember the first big page of that was Cersei standing next to Cap, and she's kind of like really pressing him with her, assets, shall we say.
Cersei is a siren.
She was trying to attract Cap, but it's funny because in that one, each time you saw her, you got to see full body image of her. Whereas this one, we're really not. It's like Byrne went to pains to not focus on any other part of her than her face. Because even a later page where it's just her and the beast as they're fighting Octogroot, you just see her head. Then the next page, the Vision's cape is covering her up, except for her face. And then there towards the end, there's another one where she's standing next to Cap. Again, all we're getting to see is her face. And Byrne is not focusing on any other aspect, not showing any other aspect of her. Oh, there's one shot where Iron Man is knocked through the wall and the water's coming in and they all come in. But even so, she's in the far background compared to the other characters. He really didn't want to put any focus on her if he didn't have to. Just used her for the story points, and that was really about it.
Yeah, and she doesn't really, other than...
Seven rides.
Yeah, but other than I hope my synopsis was clear, she changes them into water. I guess she gives them gills or something. She changes them all into water breathers until they enter this underwater base, and then she changes them back into air breathers. So I guess she doesn't want to, other than that, she doesn't really lend a lot of, other than saying that they've been at war with the deviants for for a millennia, she doesn't really lend any more information about the situation.
Yeah, you'd think that would be her. This would be her leading the charge.
Yeah, that's why Cap brought her in. The fight between Cap and Storm is nice. That upper panel scene where she's blasting him with either rain or loose water or something. It looks like he's in a, he says he's in a, you know, small scale hurricane.
Yeah, that's a cool image. Him sitting there behind the shield.
I didn't pick up on that. Cap says, I forgot at this time, everybody thought the X-Men were dead. Mm-hmm. He says, she's lashing at me with a small scale hurricane. Who is this woman? She had her powers match those of Storm of the X-Men, but they're dead. I'd forgotten that they were, this is when they're hiding out in
Australia,
right? Forgot about that. So it makes sense that he wouldn't think that is Storm.
And the Omega level mutant is taken out by the Wasp
state. Well, surprise him.
What I think is funny is towards the last page, the second to last page, as the Beast slams his hand into the artifact, which is funny because the artifact looks like it is about to break anyway. If you could snap off a piece of it with your fingers, but for the She-Hulk, it's pretty tough. But after that, you see She-Hulk is actually taking Wonder Man down, which I figure he's probably at least 25% stronger than her, since he's almost at Thor's level. With Thor's class 100, She-Hulk was rated at 75 tons.
75, yeah. Well, he's class 100, I believe. Well, he says, how am I supposed to fight all of these women without hurting them? So he's probably pulling his punches.
Oh, there's that. Yeah, that's right.
He doesn't want to hurt him.
Yeah. And She-Hulk is sitting there yelling in his ear, go ahead and do what you can do.
Yeah.
Do us. We can't help ourselves. That would be so... that would definitely be a conflict.
Well, I thought that was interesting that they are controlled, but not controlled the way you normally think they would be. That they have, and the She-Hulk says this earlier in the issue, that she has complete free will, except when she tries to deviate from what Gower orders her to do. Then she feels compelled to do it. Other than that,
that's the weird thing, because the She-Hulk is sitting there telling them, you know, go ahead and fight us. We're not in control of ourselves. She's at least got control of her voice there. But then the moment the Beast slams that thing, and Andromeda and Jean are both like, he rises.
Yeah,
they're happy. So it's so weird the way that works. Whew. And then that nice big double page spread of Set or the Serpent Crown or Tiamat. Tiamat's more dragons.
Mm-hmm.
But seven brides for seven heads. Well, does anybody have any other thoughts on this one?
No, I mean, Nigel, you've been kind of quiet. You've read this before, so.
Yeah, I originally had it, and then, of course, I've read it over the last couple of nights again, because I'd forgotten some of what happened in this. I could remember the brides all being elected, of course, and I'd forgotten about the sending them off on those quests to find different things. But yeah, and as I say, I just regret having got rid of my copy.
You could probably get a copy this cheap. I bet you can get a copy this cheap.
Although, going back to what Brian said a while ago about the quality of it with that muddy printing.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember rightly, my original copy was probably a bit muddy like this. But this digital copy that I found that I'm looking at is really clean and nice, and the coloring's really good. I don't think my original issue looked as good as this.
No, this is back. This wasn't on like the slick paper. I'm sure this was newsprint paper back still.
Yeah,
when you were .
Yeah.
Okay.
If we're gonna read the other two. Later installments, this was part 12 of 14, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
if anybody was going to read 13 and 14 in the original issue, we can just have a little bicycle circulation here. That just sent me the 13th and 14th installments, because I'd like to see how bad that artwork is and read it, but I don't want to invest in it, and I don't want to go on eBay to go buy them. Oh. If somebody in our group is going to pick up those copies, I'll split it with you.
Well, I'll see if I've got, because it's Thor Annual 14 is the next one, and then it concludes in FF Annual 22. Yeah. I'll have to look and see if I have those or not.
I'm looking at the beginning of the Thor one now. Who's the team? Roy Thomas wrote it. Al Milgram breakdowns. Don Heck finishes. So not the greatest of artwork. Not after reading West Coast 4. This were a bit of a shock. Yeah. It could be worse, but it's only kind of mediocre artwork. I remember this because the first time you see the heads of Set, you think, oh, God, is this really the same creature? I know. And all the event, it kind of goes back to where it left off after a few pages. And all the Avengers are drawn, as Milgram usually does, kind of like small and well. He tries to cram a lot into one picture.
I got to ask one other thing. Going back into the book, page 23. Now, that's the one where Wonder Man and the Beast are trying to hold She-Hulk back. And looking at that, the four figures, the Beast, She-Hulk, and Wonder Man, don't even look like Byrne drew them.
Oh, this bit, yeah.
And the back figures, I mean, maybe he just did a breakdown of this page, but it does not, I mean, it just doesn't look like he drew it.
Yeah.
The only thing that is the giveaway that could say he did it is She-Hulk's hair.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, it doesn't look exactly like the rest of it.
Yeah.
As you say.
I'm wondering if I just made this connection. We talked about Dagger earlier, about her being blind. The series that was started a year ago before this came out was written by Terry Austin. And I wonder if that's maybe why Byrne had the choice, why he picked Dagger, because Terry Austin was working on that book a year prior, and he picked her as a favor or as a nod or something. I don't know.
Well, I don't even know. I mean, all that happened before Byrne got involved, got into his issues.
Mm. Exactly. So I don't know. That may just be a coincidence.
Bringing Dagger into it was probably, they went to Bill Mantlo and they said, hey, who do you think would be good in this?
Dagger came in from, they captured her in Spectacular Spider-Man Annual 9, or they marked her in that, and that was the sixth part of the story, so fairly early on.
Yeah, that Fantastic Four Annual is kind of standard fare for some of it.
Well, these big crossover annuals were, I thought, were very hit or miss. For, they had this, they had, you mentioned the Terminus Effect, yeah, something.
Terminus Factor.
Yeah, something.
I bought those, or most of them. Again, the same sort of thing.
Yeah, they did. Go ahead, Kirk.
Well, I was going to say, I'm not sure that this is entirely accurate, but I heard that Byrne and Peter David have always been somewhat at odds with each other. From what I understand, there was a furious debate after this came out between the two, on the pages of Comic Buyer's Guide, sort of industry newspaper, about whether or not it had been justified to treat the women the way they were treated specifically. If I'm remembering this right, Byrne was upset that Peter David had written something where Jean Grey had been raped as part of the storyline. I can't swear that that's true, but I think Peter David's response was, what can I say? That's what happened. And Byrne went off the handle, as I recall, saying, what do you mean that's what happened? You're the writer. You determine what happened. Is this any of this ring bells, or am I completely off base?
I know they've had a few, web arguments, but I never heard about Jean Grey being, handled in that way. As far as things that they've done to women characters, well, every writer in the Marvel, pantheon has pretty much done something horrible to women. I mean, whenever you're writing heroic fiction of any kind, there's always going to be somebody in distress. 9 times out of 10, it's a damsel. And just horrible things happen. I mean, if you look at the Hulk
storylines that, you know, Peter David wrote, the things that happened to Betty, the things that happened to Marlo, it wasn't nice. It wasn't pretty, you know, and when he was on Spider-Man, he kills Jean DeWolf, which was a fan favorite character. And there was a large thing that was written out there somewhere about the misogyny of comic book writers. You could go on and on for hours pointing out all the various things, all the female characters that get killed in the name of moving the story forward or establishing tragedy in a hero's past. It's, you know, it's the way things were for a long, long time. I mean, just remember how remember how the Invisible Girl was treated for so long. Oh, I've got to use my force field powers. Oh, I've got a headache. You know, it was just, and again, if you weren't a man, you were a boy, okay, you're robbing the boy hostage. It's always been, you know, like that for a long, long time. And it's taken us a long time to get away from that.
Yeah, but in the, from the count from, say, the Silver Age on, the majority of deaths were male. I mean, yes, they started where they would kill off female characters, but think of Uncle Ben. There's Bucky, you know, there's Captain Marvel. Most of those heroes, I mean, yeah, the first big female death is Jean Grey, at least a significant character. Gwen Stacy. That's true. Yeah, I'll stand corrected. That is Gwen Stacy.
And then you got the two Marthas, but that's origin.
Yeah. You know, but that's
Captain Stacy too.
Captain Stacy, yeah, yep, that's true. The Green Goblin. I mean, you know, he's a bad guy, but he was killed. Osborn, yeah. I mean, you could argue that the reason why most of the men were the ones that met their death was because it was mostly male characters as prominent, as mostly males were prominent characters, not females. So if now maybe it's because we're getting more, we slowly started getting more female characters. They were starting to meet their end as well. But, you know, nobody stays dead in comics other than Uncle Ben. So everybody can come back.
We're working on it. So are we just about completed here, folks? It's been about an hour.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to say on it. We're not covering the other stories in it, so this was kind of short and sweet.
We're not going to discuss Supergirl, so you know.
No. Well, yeah.
Sorry, couldn't help myself there.
Well, the Flash died in that as well, so you got one for both sides. You got a male and a female
died. Oh, so many died. So many died. We could probably, I mean, the thing is, if you pull up a list, there's going to be more men than women in crisis.
Yep.
Just because there were more men heroes. So, yeah.
Well, I think we can, unless anybody has anything else, I think we can close this up. We are almost done with our West Coast Avengers run. We have two more. Let's see. This time we have 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 57 to cover. And to peel back the curtain a little bit, we're recording this out of sequence, so we've actually already recorded our final issues of it, but we decided to cover this and we'll slot it in and release. Then we'll be done with West Coast Avengers, and then I don't know what we're going to do next, but we'll see. You know, we've got a couple things coming down the pike.
You can let us know, lovely listener. You can always write to us at gottagetburned@gmail.com, or there's a Facebook page, like, and message that's a little faster. Also, a review for Apple Tunes, or is it iTunes? I can never keep that straight.
Apple Podcast, formerly iTunes.
So there are a lot of ways to get a hold of us. I want to thank the panel for discussing this so early. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
And Brian B.
You're welcome.
And Nigel.
Enjoyed it. You're welcome.
So I guess out of comments, unless somebody has something else that wraps up our coverage, we'll see you next week for another drop of another episode in our continuing coverage. I'm Kirk Greenfield. Thanks for coming along.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together today. Marriage, that blessed arrangement, that dream within a dream. Then love. True love will follow you forever. So treasure your wife.
Man and wife. Say man and wife.
Man and wife.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.